Hi, this is Perry, and you're listening to the Chemist's Corner for Friday, November 1st, 2013. We've got an interesting show for you today. Today's interview will be with Bob Bornfriend, who is an expert in manufacturing and scale-up and is currently the primary consultant at Personal Care Process Engineering, LLC. We haven't previously talked to anyone in the process engineering role of the cosmetic industry, so the interview should be of interest to anyone who is concerned with scale-up. And speaking of scale-up, in our cosmetic science section, we are going to discuss some general guidelines to scaling up cosmetic formulations. There is a lot to consider when going from a beaker to a 2,000-gallon tank. But first, let's talk about some of the beauty science stories that have piqued my interest in the last couple of weeks. Revlon fights back. Here's a story which shows that not everyone is overreacting to the NGO scaremongering. While big companies like P&G and J&J have vowed to reformulate some of their products, even though they think their current products are perfectly safe, Revlon has taken a different tact and has fought back against the claims of some of these fearmongering groups. According to a story on cosmetics design, three NGO groups, including the Campaign for Safe Cosmetics, the Breast Cancer Fund, and Ultraviolet, teamed up for a letter-writing campaign urging Revlon to stop selling, quotes, "cosmetics laced with cancer-causing chemicals." Now, a lot of companies might ignore this, or they might come out with a press release saying that they're going to reformulate. But Revlon took a different tack. Revlon's response came from their Senior Vice President of Corporate Communications, Christine Taylor, who deemed the campaign as false and misleading. And she further defended Revlon, calling on the government for stronger regulations for cosmetics. Now, I, for one, am glad to see a big company finally standing up to these groups that use junk science to scare consumers and manipulate companies. This really is a win for critical thinking and science, and I really wish companies like J&J and P&G would have followed suit, and they wouldn't kowtow to these companies and or to these NGOs and their threats. You can't give in to these NGOs when their conclusions are not based on evidence, but instead fear, because it propagates fear of chemicals, fear of cosmetics, and ultimately, it's leading to cosmetics that don't perform nearly as well. They're less safe, or maybe less safe. We don't know because they're not tested, and they just aren't better. So, kudos to Revlon. Here's another story I found interesting. Makes you think about the proteins that you're getting. A lot of people love to formulate natural products. Well, in this report out of China, it says that there is an increase in the production of a natural protein source that many consumers might not find too appealing. According to the LA Times, cockroach farms are on the rise in China. Right now, there are about 100 of these farms, but the numbers keep growing. And what do they do with the cockroaches? Well, besides having to corral them when they escape, there is a story that a million of these cockroaches escape from one farm. What they do with them is they use them as a source of protein for cosmetic products. Specifically, they are used as, say, a bulking agent for other types of protein materials, but they are derived from cockroaches nonetheless. So the next time you're mixing up your silk protein or your collagen protein into your batch, it just might be filled with amino acids that came from a farm of creepy crawling critters. Now, I wonder if people who produce all natural cosmetics would go for the material. I mean, they are all naturals. And could you use cockroach protein and still call your products cruelty-free? Or say they don't contain animal products? I wonder. And finally, speaking of natural products, I recently was reminded of a challenge that the Royal Society of Chemistry put out in 2010, and it's still available today if anyone wants to attempt it. If you can achieve the challenge, they will pay you £1 million, which in the US is about $1.6 million. The challenge? Produce an actual chemical-free product. Simple, right? We see advertisements all the time for chemical-free products. In fact, I often get requests from people who want to make chemical-free cosmetics. And I just tell them I can't, because it's impossible. Why? Of course, because all matter is a chemical. Water is a chemical, salt is a chemical, anything that you would possibly want to use in a cosmetics, or put in a bottle or sell in a jar, is going to be a chemical. I really do wonder, when people claim that something is chemical-free, what are they specifically talking about? What did they mean when they say chemical-free? I don't really know. But if you think you can produce a chemical-free product, all you have to do is contact the Royal Society of Chemistry, show them the product, and if they agree that it's chemical-free, you get your money. Somehow, I don't think they are ever going to have to pay out, though. Here's some general guidelines to scale up cosmetic formulations. We had an interesting question posed by one of our readers who has a background in chemical engineering, and specifically he wanted to know if there were some general guidelines for scaling up a formulation and creating a manufacturing procedure. Since I've never written about specifically that topic in the past, I put together 8 tips that can make your scale up from the lab to production plant a lot easier. While none of these tips will apply to every formula, they are good guidelines to help you craft your manufacturing procedures. Number 1, start with the abundance. So when you are making a batch, you should fill the tank up with the ingredient that is the most abundant in the formulation. Since the vast majority of formulations are water-based, this typically means you're going to fill the tank first with water. Now, number 2, put in your powders. Since many water-soluble powders can take a long time to disperse or dissolve, it's best to get those things going right away. So get those mixed in first. This will speed things up considerably. You also don't have to necessarily wait until every bit of the powder is evenly mixed into the formula before adding the next ingredient on top. Most of it should be in there, but you don't have to wait for it all to dissolve. Tip 3. Heating helps, usually. Even if a formulation doesn't need to be heated to melt the ingredients, it is often helpful to heat something up a little bit just to speed things up. In general, warmer ingredients take less time to blend. No, this is not always the case, though. In fact, a lot of cellulose raw materials often go into solution faster when you put it into cold water, interestingly enough. Number 4, go 10 degrees C higher. When you are creating an emulsion or working with solids that need to be heated past their melting point, like acetyl alcohol, stearyl alcohol, a good guide for manufacturing is to heat the batch 10 degrees C higher than the highest melting point of the ingredients you are using. For most emulsions, this means your batch should be anywhere from 75 to 80 degrees C. Tip number 5, 28 minutes of mixing. While it depends on your mixing tank, a minimum of 20 minutes mixing after blending the oil and water phase together is really needed. If you don't have good turnover, it really could take longer, so it's going to really depend on the equipment that you have. Number 6, add fragrances and preservatives last. Since these ingredients can break down when heated, it is best to add them at the very end when all your heating and cooling is completed. This will minimize ingredient degradation. Number 7, color early. You should add your colors early on in the batch, and then you can check the color versus a color standard. If you have made a mistake, you can easily pitch the batch of water, colored water, without that costing you too much. If you put your colors in at the end of your batch and you make a mistake, which is very easy to do with colors, that could cause you to have to dump the entire batch, which could cost you a lot of money. Finally, neutralize at the end. Neutralize your formula that require it, things like gels and anything with carbomer, you should do that at the end. This should be the last ingredient you add, as it will help to minimize the amount of air that you get in the formula. Of course, these are just general guidelines, and every specific cosmetic formulation is going to be different. Sometimes things that work easily in the lab don't work so easily in a 2,000-gallon tank, so of course, as with anything in science, it's going to take some experimentation. Thank you.
Bob Borfren is highly experienced in a variety of R&D, quality, engineering, and manufacturing positions. He's had extensive exposure to product, project, and process development in chemical and consumer products industries. During his career, he has been a key liaison between R&D and operations and has advised corporations on internal and external manufacturing sites and process optimization. He's worked on projects around the world, including in North America, South America, Europe, Africa, Asia Pacific, China, and more. His primary product categories include hair care, skin care, and color cosmetics. Currently, Bob is the owner of Personal Care Process Engineering, LLC. Welcome to the program, Bob.
Thank you, Barry. Good to be here.
Well, Bob, we had you on because we haven't in the past had anybody talk to us about process engineering, and it's one of the fields that people can go into if they get a chemical engineering degree. So we want to give people a sense of what does it mean to be a process engineer and how do they do it. But before we get into that, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got started in the cosmetic industry?
Okay. Well, I started working for Cheeseboro Ponds in Trumbull, Connecticut, working on their products in skincare and hair care. Some of the skincare brands that people would recognize would be Vaseline, Intensive Care, and Rave hair products and things like that. From there, I went to a color cosmetics company making cosmetic pencils called Cosmo Lab in Tennessee. And from there, Alberto Colbert in Chicago, which we all know is or was big in hair care before being bought out by Ewing.
That's right. I should mention that you and I used to work together for some time.
That is true. And typically, the interface that we had is typical of what process engineers and formulators do in the real world, which is the formulators come up with new products, test it out in the lab, and developing a process on the bench using lab scale equipment. And then the process engineers, such as myself, will come in and apply that basic approach to larger scale equipment and commercial technology.
So the process engineers are really the connection between the people in the lab and the people out in production.
That's exactly right. A lot of the things that are done on the bench are not truly scalable to the real world. For example, if you have a laboratory glass beaker and a lab mixer, you're actually putting in quite a bit of energy into a small volume of product. And that doesn't translate very well to the real world. So typically we go through a pilot scale stage where we would try to use equipment that resembles equipment that is found on the production floor and develop the process further in the pilot scale and then scale it up to full-size production with the process engineer in attendance of the first few batches. Make sure that the process can still produce the same product quality and consistency of properties from batch to batch. That's a key part of the commercialization of the new product, which is to make sure that not only can you produce it once, but you can produce it multiple times and come out with the same properties every time.
One of the things I noticed about the process engineers at Alberta was that they ended up traveling around the country and in some cases around the world a lot. What's the reason that process engineers tend to do a lot of traveling?
Well, in a company that has multiple sites, especially if they're around the world, it's key to apply the knowledge that's gained in the first scale-ups. And that might be, for example, in the main plant that's located at the company's primary site, which in Alberto's case was in Melrose Park. You learn a lot of things in that first scale-up, and then translating those learnings to other sites requires the same person or team of people people to make sure that those learnings are rolled out to the other plants as the production is rolled out.
Typically, the other plants are going to have equipment that might be a little different, too.
Well, that is true, and that's part of the mystery of process engineering, which makes it exciting as well, because it's basically a problem-solving occupation where you always run into new things and new twists that require problems to be solved in the field, and it's important to solve those problems.
Can you give us an example of some interesting problem you had to solve?
The first one that comes to mind is when I was still working at Cheeseboro Ponds, and we were rolling out a new updated formula for Vaseline Intensive Care Lotion, and it was all developed in batch processes in the main plant in Connecticut, but they also had a plant using a continuous process, which turned out to produce a completely different product or set of properties for that product, and we were already in the rollout stage, so we had a crisis to resolve in making sure that we could duplicate the same properties on the continuous process that we had on the batch process. And that took a lot of people and a lot of time to do, and it was under a time pressure of meeting the ship-to-market date that the company had committed to.
Yeah, well, it's a good thing they had a team of process engineers, huh?
Exactly.
A lot of the people who listen to the show they work for smaller companies, or maybe they're even entrepreneurs. How could a small company like that benefit from working with a process engineer?
I think that the biggest benefit is that you get someone who's experienced in scale-up procedures and scale-up issues that require solving, so that you get the most economical result that you can depend on is going to produce the same product properties every time you make a batch. Just having a formula and a process that was developed on the bench doesn't guarantee you that you're going to be able to make it reliably, and that's the key part of using a process engineer, is to make sure that everything goes smoothly on the scale up, and you're not wasting time solving problems on a large scale that should have been resolved much earlier.
Now, if we're thinking about people who want to go into the field of process engineering, what kind of advice would you have for somebody who might be just starting out? How could they get into this?
Well, I think that the easiest way to enter the field is through a larger company, because they hire many more process engineers. And process engineering, let's face it, is somewhat of a specialty. So smaller companies don't necessarily recognize the need for that until they've developed a lot more than just being a startup company. Not to say that they can't go out and hire someone to do that for them, but it's generally easier for someone starting in the industry to find work at a large company. I will say, though, that I do prefer working for a smaller company, because you get to do so many more different things that you wouldn't get to do in a large company, where you tend to be pushed into a niche and don't get exposed to quite as many things. Having said that, if you're looking to find a position in the industry, widen the scope to include not just cosmetic companies, but food and drug companies as well, because the technology is very much the same, the equipment is very similar, and in a lot of cases is acquired from the very same equipment vendors for a cosmetic company that the food companies use or the pharma companies use. And then once you've gotten that experience working for a larger company and getting the scale-up experience, that can be applied to cosmetic companies just as easily, because the learnings are the same, the techniques are the same, we make them the same.
Well, that's very interesting. Now, you have recently started your own company, consulting company. What does your company do, and what kind of customers could benefit from this?
We work for a variety of different companies, mostly the smaller companies, because, as I alluded to before, they don't typically have their own staff of engineers. And we provide the same kind of problem-solving and scale-up services that you would need to do when you're moving from a formula and a bench process to a commercial process. Most people without their own facilities then will go to look for a contract manufacturer, and my company can help in that respect as well, because the contract manufacturers need someone knowledgeable about the process and their equipment, who can also represent the entrepreneur and the formula owner in getting the best possible results from their association with that contract manufacturer. So we can represent the small entrepreneur and work with the contract manufacturers as well to ensure the best possible results in the most economical process.
Well, thanks a lot, Bob. And if people wanted to get in touch with you, get some advice from you, or use your services, how would they do that?
I can be reached through my website, www.personalcarepe.com. It's PE as in process engineer. And there's a background information there, as well as contact information for getting a hold of me. And I'd be pleased to work with anyone.
All right, Bob. We will certainly put links to that in the show notes, so if people want to get you, they can go right through there. And thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today.
Thank you for having me, Perry. I appreciate it.
Well, that brings us to the end of our program. Thank you so much for listening. And coming up in December, we have the New York SCC meeting, in which will be a great scientific event. And so if you're in the New York area or can get there, it's a great program to go. Go to scconline.org to find out more information about that. And as always, we're having a great discussions going on in our Cosmetic Science Forum. We've had a lot of new people sign up, and there's a lot of activity going on there. So if you ever have a question or comment or want to talk about cosmetic science and cosmetic formulating, I encourage you to check out chemistcorner.com/cosmeticsciencetalk. And it's free to join the forum. And there's over 2,100 conversations already over there. So feel free to go there. Also, I've launched a new book on my other website. It's called the website is thebeautybrains.com, but the book is called "It's Okay to Have Lead in Your Lipstick," and it's real scientists answering beauty questions that are sent in by real consumers, and it's a excellent book, and it's great for the holiday time, which is coming up. So if you're interested in that book, go to thebeautybrains.com and you can see how to purchase it there. You can also get the book on amazon.com, and I'm going to put a link on the Chemist Corner website so you can get it there. As always, you can follow us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter, Chemist Corner, and we look forward to communicating with you in that way too. I'm Perry Romanowski, and thanks for listening. Now, go make a difference.